Made possible with support from the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, presenting Swing from Wednesday, June 22nd through Sunday, July 3rd, a celebration of the music and dance that swept the nation in the 30s and 40s, highlighting an eclectic mix of jive, Latin swing, West Coast swing, hip-hop swing, and country western swing. Ticket information is available at 1-888-261-9675.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Susan and Lou Hopkins bet there are a number of you who believe WILL's worth at least 28 cents a day, but for some reason you've never contributed. So, to help you make the move, they'll add $10 to your contribution. If the information you get here is worth at least 28 cents a day, mail a check for $100 or more to Friends of WILL, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, 61801. The Hopkins will add $10 to say thanks for becoming a new friend of WILL Urbana, and we thank you too.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Women are the fastest growing group of inmates in the nation. Why? What crimes are they serving time for? What happens to them in prison? What happens to their families while they're incarcerated? And how do they fare after they served their time? These are the questions we'll take up this afternoon with investigative journalist Christina Rathbone. She spent 5 years researching this story. As part of her research, she spent a great deal of time visiting prisoners in America's oldest operating prison for women, MCI Framingham, in Massachusetts. The prison is more than 125 years old. She tells their stories in her book, A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Christina Rathbone has written for many magazines and newspapers, including the New York Daily News and the Miami Herald. She is the author of On the Outside Looking In, A Year in an Inner City High School. Her new book, A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars, is published by Random House. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Christina, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you for asking me to be here.
So describe for us, if you would, MCI Framingham.
It is, in many respects, a very typical women's prison in America today, though it does have this extraordinary history. In the mid-20th century to today, it has become pretty standard and falls pretty much in the middle of women's prisons across the nation, which is to say it's a rather arid, secluded, isolated place, offering very little in the way of programming or educational opportunity to the women who serve overly long sentences there, for the most part for nonviolent crimes. So though it is extraordinary in its history, it's really very ordinary in its day-to-day existence.
Yeah. What was the prison like when it opened in 1877?
It was a very forward-looking place of reform. A couple of women's prisons had opened before it opened its gates, but they had closed soon after. And just the existence of a prison for women alone was a very radical step. Prior to that, women had basically been housed in the darkened attic rooms or small cellars of men's prisons, where they were offered nothing by way of education or training or even work to keep them occupied, and where they were hardly ever let out. So they were real dungeons, and this was a great step forward to offer them a place of their own where they could exist in safety, because, of course, trapped in the bowels of a men's prison, they were often preyed upon both by male guards and male inmates as sexual prey.
Yeah. Now, when the prison opened in 1877, it was held up as a model. Mm-hmm. And life, it seems, was relatively pleasant. I mean, you're not a free person in prison no matter what, but it seems to me it was a much better place than Framingham is today.
Yep, the history of women's prison is rather depressingly circular in that it oscillates between periods of reform and then periods of retrenchment, which take it back to where it was before the period of reform started. Then a period of reform sets in, and another period of retrenchment, round and round in this never-ending circle, which means we never get very far. When it opened, certainly the emphasis was on rehabilitation, which means the emphasis was on education, on job training, on other extracurricular activities that built up individual women's self-esteem, and that was very much where everyone was looking. When the program became too successful, people outside the prison, people in the larger correctional system, which were mainly men, grew afraid that prisons would cease to be something that frightened would-be criminals. And on those grounds, they would pull back the reforms and then again make it a place of punishment, not reform. And then the cycle would start all over again. Now I think I hope that we're coming towards the end of a period of punishment-minded corrections across this country. And because of budget deficits and because it doesn't seem to have worked very well, I think we're now beginning the very, very, very early stages of entering a period of reform.
Yeah. Do you think we'll see reforms in the country's drug laws?
That is central to any question to do with prisons in America today, of course. We incarcerate more people than any other country on earth. We have more than 2 million people in prison today, mostly because of our war on drugs and mostly because of our mandatory drug sentencing laws. It's amazing to see that these laws that were established to incarcerate drug kingpins and, you know, big drug lords, in fact, has actually ended up just incarcerating hundreds of thousands of the lowliest of lowly drug dealers, most of whom are drug addicts themselves, and particularly when we're dealing with women, who are oftentimes the girlfriends or the wives or the roommates or the lovers of drug dealers, and they are now being put in prison at five times the rate of men. And it's in large part because of these drug laws that send you to prison for the amount of drugs involved in a crime without any regard for your role in that crime. Mm. And that's the real catch. So you can have a tiny role in the crime or no role. You can be living in the apartment where the drugs are stashed, and you are just as liable to be sentenced to 5, 10, 15 years as the person who arranged the whole drug deal.
Yeah. And the sentences seem so out of whack in terms of other kinds of offenses. And this is something that Denise, at some point, one of the women that you profile in A World Apart, she sends you a letter and she rails about this. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a wonderful letter she sent me. Denise is a wonderful woman who was serving 5 years and a day. Again, such a bizarre sentence. For her first offense, nonviolent drug dealing. She was a crack addict at the time and a mother of a 9-year-old boy. And it was this, her motherhood, which was really driving her crazy while she was in prison, because while she was incapacitated in MCI Framingham, her son was left unprotected, of course. And in the 5 years she was in prison, her son, who went from being a perfectly normal, healthy 9-year-old boy, was abused and beaten up very badly by his father, was then removed from his father's care and become a ward of the state, and then was bounced from foster home to foster home, and ultimately was so unhappy that he ended up shoplifting in order to be caught so that he could be sent to a juvenile facility. And when she was finally released 5 years after she was sent away, the terrible irony is that he was in a juvenile detention center himself and couldn't meet with her until 6 weeks later when he was released. So it was that drove Denise and, in fact, most of the women I met at Framingham most sad, the fact that they were in a position where they could not do anything to help their children, many of whom were suffering a great, great deal as a result of not having their mothers with them.
Yeah. Well, in this letter that she sends you, she talks about, maybe she sent you a clipping from a newspaper,
yeah,
and setting out names of people who were convicted of raping children, of,
right,
and, you know, assault and battery upon children, receiving much lighter sentences than she had received.
Yeah, and it was a little wire article. These stories aren't worth large articles anymore. No one's really interested in reading them, which is another subject. But she found this article which outlined, I think it was about 10 offenders against children, mostly sexual, but sometimes assault and battery, and their sentences, which ranged, I think, from 1 year to 5 years. And even the five-year sentences could be bargained down. And not only were they serving more time than Denise, whose sentence could not be bargained down, and she could not earn any good time, but Denise also points out in that letter that the people who are abusing these children then set these children on the path to become drug addicts, to counter the terrible shame they feel at having been abused, and then they're drug addicts, then they become nonviolent offenders themselves, and then they get sent to prison following the path of their mothers before them. And, Denise, like many women in prison, was more than intelligent enough to see the incredible injustice in this.
Yeah. Well, like Denise, most of Framingham's inmates are mothers. You describe their cells as being decorated with photos of their kids and cards, made with construction paper and crayon by their children. So are most of the women young? Are most of their children then young?
I'm not sure what the average age of women in prison is nationwide. I would guess it's somewhere around 32 or 33. Two-thirds of them are mothers and primary caretakers of minor children. So, the majority of them were living at home with children under the age of 18 when they were sent away. Children very much in need of their mother's presence.
Yeah. Well, Charlene, when she was sentenced, she had a 16-month-old baby girl. And she was sentenced to 15 years and a day.
Yeah. And again, it was her very first ever criminal offense. She had no criminal record before this. She herself was a 19-year-old and was offered $10,000 to bring some drugs into the country. She didn't even really believe it was ever going to happen. And obviously, it was a very foolish, wrong-headed decision she made to go along with it. But it's a decision that I can fully understand her making. And that indeed I and many people I know might well have made if we were in the same position ourselves. When it became real to her that she really was going to be required to bring drugs into the country, she, became very afraid and didn't want to do it at all, tried to get out of it. But at that point, you can't get out of a drug deal when you're dealing with real drug dealers with real weapons who have a real stake in getting you to smuggle those drugs in. Fearful for her life, she did what she was being told, but because she wasn't a professional criminal in any way, she looked terrified and was picked up immediately as soon as she arrived at Logan Airport. I mean, she was obviously stressed out. And that was that, 15 years and a day in prison, with no leeway granted for the fact that she had a little child, or that this was her first offense, or that she was, gainfully employed. A judge has no say in the length of sentence that they give to someone convicted under a mandatory drug law, and that's why judges across the country have spoken out so uniformly against them.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed for Charlene's daughter. By the time Charlene gets out, her daughter will be almost, let's hope, almost ready to graduate from high school.
Let's hope. One of the things that makes so little sense is that the children of these women who get sent to prison do tend to spiral down themselves. Of course, many are very resilient, and they need to be. But I heard a man the other day speak of these children of women in prison as being very overdrawn emotionally, and that they need massive deposits of love all the time because they are separated from their mothers. Mm. And oftentimes there just isn't enough time or energy to go around to give them the kind of love that they need to survive life without their mothers. And again, then the problems that came to the mother go to the next generation. And we, by supporting these drug laws, are allowing and enabling this to happen.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, journalist Christina Rathbone. She is the author of A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions. Comments also invited. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. This story presented you with a huge challenge. You met a great deal of resistance, to say the very least, from the Massachusetts Department of Corrections. Tell us about that.
Like most states in this country, the Massachusetts Department of Corrections has a slew of ways to deny media access to their prisons. They're very used to having total control over the worlds they run inside a prison, and they don't want any of them to have the media or anybody else see what's going on. So when I first requested access in the year 2000, they turned me down on a reason. They decided that my book might upset victims of crimes, which on the surface could seem reasonable, except that the women that I was intending to meet with, as the majority of women in prison, nearly 80% are serving time for nonviolent crimes, so they aren't really the type of crimes that have victims. And the ACLU and a corporate law firm here did the legal work pro bono and sued the Department of Corrections, and we won access that time. And then a year later, I was forced to sue the Department of Corrections again when I wanted to gain access to a wonderful program in the prison run by the Girl Scouts, Girl Scouts Beyond Bars, and they just didn't want me there either. So they're very, very reluctant, as are departments of corrections across the states, to allow anybody in. And this, I think, is the first building block that needs to be constructed if we're going to be able to change the correction system nationwide, and that is to have more public oversight of these prisons to prevent abuse from starting and to prevent the kind of malaise that's settled in across the country.
Mm. What's the daily routine like at Framingham?
As in many women's prisons, it's rather empty. As I said before, there's very little in the way of programming and education offered to women in prison. And so you wake up and you wake up with what they call count, which happens four or five times a day, where you have to stand by your bunk and be counted. And then the day is divided up into periods called movement, which are the periods when you're allowed to move from one section of the prison to another. And you might be able to have found a job in the prison, in which case you do that in between these periods of movement. And if you haven't got a high school degree, as about 50% of women don't, you might be able to get a space in a GED program. And otherwise, that's pretty much it. Hmm. There's lots of sitting around on a bunk bed watching television, which drives the women in prison just as crazy as it does irate taxpayers who can't bear the thought of paying for women just to sit around and watch TV. It's really a terrible, terrible waste of time.
Yeah. Tell us about Denise's process of settling into the routine. It took her a little time before she realized.
That she was in prison.
Yeah.
I think, as is the case with many women in prison, Denise had had no contact with the criminal justice system before going in. She hadn't led an ideal life by any imagination. She was a crack addict and she was an exotic dancer. But nonetheless, she was semi-functional and was bringing up her child and went to work every day and paid the rent and the telephone bill. And all of a sudden, she was in prison and had no say over any element of her life, including what she ate, what she wore, what time she woke up, where she walked, when she walked, who she spoke to. And it took months for her to really realize that this was real. For the first couple of months, she felt like she must just be in some kind of dream, and she persisted in that belief until she realized that if she kept deluding herself that way, she wouldn't be able to deal with life in prison. And she realized, as most women in prison do, that the only way to survive your time there, and to survive because of their children, in the name of their children, was to give way to the reality of prison, which is a very, very hard thing to do without becoming completely demoralized.
Mm.
It takes a lot of strength and a lot of courage and a lot of intelligence to remain more or less whole for a 5, a 10, a 15-year sentence, even a 3 or a 2-year sentence.
What are the visits like between mothers and their children?
I think the most important thing to say about those visits is that they're very rare. Across the country, more than 60% of women are more than 100 miles away from their children. Because women are still a minority in the prison system, prisons tend to be much further away from the women's place of residence. And the financial cost of getting a child from their home to the prison is often prohibitive. Of those 60% of mothers, less than half report even one visit with their children since being sent to prison. So in many cases, due often to lack of programming and lack of assistance and lack of emphasis on maintaining relationships between mothers and their children, there simply aren't any. I spoke just the other day in D.C. with a 17-year-old daughter of a woman in prison, and when someone in the audience asked her how she felt about visits with her mother, she said, we only visit her once a year. And it was a great ordeal for her to manage to do that. So just the fact of a visit is so miraculous, so precious, that it often becomes fraught. And you sit in a public room. In Framingham, you are allowed to touch the children. You're not behind plexiglass or anything like that. But there's a tension, a fear of the end of the visit that pervades the entire thing. A mother doesn't want to completely connect with their child for fear that they won't be able to cope with that child leaving. And I can't speak for the children because children's minds work differently, of course. But I can speak as a mother, and I can imagine that feeling.
Yeah. You write in A World Apart, almost all the women I've met at Framingham have become exaggerated versions of themselves in one way or another. What do you mean?
I think what I was trying to get across was this notion that because life is, your choices are so minimal in prison, and because you do the same things over and over again, your personality tends to get shaped by your day, as it does with all of us in all of our lives. But because the days are so the same, your personality gets a little distorted. You grow in those directions, but you grow in the directions that aren't necessarily healthy. So you grow in the direction of having no control over your life. You grow in the direction of being locked into your room every night. You grow in the direction of being treated at best like a child and at worst like a non-human. You grow into those and begin to accept them, and that begins to become their reality. And this is why it's very, very hard for women and men, even after short sentences, to adjust to life, free life on the outside. And it's why it's so important that we start really focusing on reentry programs and on bridge programs that will bridge life on the inside with life on the outside to make those transitions possible, even for people who don't have children. For women who do have children, of course, the problems are multiplied 10, 100-fold even.
Yeah. How has prison shaped Julie's version of herself? Tell us about Julie.
Julie was the youngest woman I met at Framingham. She was just 21 when I met her, and was a sort of wild, bad girl type, daughter of a policeman, interestingly. But also a heroin addict, a long-term heroin addict, and a girlfriend of a man who was an armed robber. She and Julie used to stay out in the car, but it was for armed robbery that she was sent to prison. And the way she got through her time was basically by engaging in sexual relationships with the male guards in the prison and by flirting and that whole kind of approach to life. And indeed, she did. Her personality grew in that direction very much, so that the longer she was in prison, the more she spent her energies on sexual activity with the guards, which ultimately didn't do her much good psychologically or emotionally, of course. And I like to believe that she came to realize that before she was released, though that could just be me being optimistic.
Yeah.
She's a wonderful, intelligent, vibrant, energetic young woman with just a promising life ahead of her if she could spend a little time on herself rather than constantly on the men around her.
Yeah. In Julie's case, it was consensual.
Yeah, except, of course, there's no such thing as consensual sex between a guard and an inmate. Since 1999, almost every state has passed laws declaring sex between guards and inmates illegal. because the power imbalance is such that it can never be truly consensual. So sexual misconduct is punishable by up to 5 years in prison in Massachusetts, and that time varies from state to state, but it is definitely illegal and punishable by time in prison. This, of course, very rarely happens. Very few correction officers are ever convicted and sent away to prison, but in theory they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
But it is true that the women of MCI Framingham insist that, or not all of them, sorry, there are several cases where it's been physically coerced sex, but in the majority of cases, the women claim that the relationships are consensual. And it's very complicated. I think it's, and I get in a lot of trouble for saying this, but I think it's too easy just to say, well, you woman in prison can't tell me that that's consensual because it isn't, because you're too powerless. I find that a very tricky position to take. And I find it much more useful to listen closely to what I'm being told. And they claim the sexual relationships as their own, I think, in a way of trying to claim some power somewhere over someone, even if they don't necessarily want to have sex with any given guard. They're enabled to exert some power in some way over their lives, however detrimental that is to their lives. So it's a very complicated situation.
Yeah.
And clearly, we would all be much better served if there were no sexual relationships between guards and inmates, and if we stuck to the UN Charter of Human Rights Declaration, which insists that women be guarded only by women, and that is the case in most European countries.
Now, apparently that used to be the standard in the U.S.
Right.
When and why did it change?
It changed, actually, because women sued for access to be prison guards in male prisons. Obviously, there are many more male prisons than female prisons, and women, there were fewer job opportunities for women to serve as correction officers. So in the 70s, a bunch of different women brought suit, and the DOC were compelled to follow, no gender discrimination. So for men's prisons, women were allowed in, but on the other hand, men were allowed to guard women's prisons. And as it's worked out, it's now, in most states, more than 50% of correction officers in women's prisons are now men.
Hmm. Journalist Christina Rathbone, our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. She spent 5 years researching this story. As part of her research, she spent a great deal of time visiting prisoners in America's oldest operating prison for women, MCI Framingham, in Massachusetts. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I had a couple comments and a couple questions. Briefly, at those drug laws you were talking about, it really give insight into our ruling classes that know that you can't really get any other way. And I would guess the only way of really reversing them, these unfair drug laws, would be to find and publicize instances where the rich or the politically connected get their children off. And I'm quite sure that there are quite a few cases in which they do, but that they are actively covered up, probably with the cooperation of law enforcement. But those are just a couple comments. I had a couple questions, and that is, we have a Dwight Correctional Facility here in Illinois, which is a woman's facility, I understand. And I know that there was one instance of what I would call a political prisoner. A Puerto Rican woman had been held there, and she was fighting for independence of Puerto Rico from the United States. But I was curious if what you might say if someone asked you if you saw any instances of political imprisonment. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thanks for the question. It's an important question. I made the decision very early on in my research not to focus on political prisoners because the vast majority, I mean more than 98% of women across the country are not political prisoners. I didn't want to skew the picture and complicate the image so much with bringing in this whole other topic, but that certainly doesn't mean that there weren't political prisoners at MCI Framingham, and there were. There were several women who were incarcerated there in the 60s and 70s for revolutionary activities then, and I've since met a couple of women who are out who served long sentences for political crimes. So it is definitely an issue that certainly goes on in this country, which many people don't think it does, but it is, I think, a separate issue. And it touches on your other comment about class and prisons. The political prisoners oftentimes do come from more privileged classes who idealistic young sort of revolutionary types, especially from the 60s and 70s, whereas most of the women in prison, of course, are very poor, the poorest among us, and come from the hardest luck, hard scrabble backgrounds, predominantly inner city backgrounds. And the mandatory drug laws are set up in such a way that they predominantly ensnare and ultimately incarcerate people from the inner cities. There are instances of this where it's legally written into the laws that you have to possess infinitely less crack cocaine than powder cocaine to be subject to these mandatory laws. And, of course, crack cocaine was a drug of choice in the inner cities, whereas powder cocaine was more of a drug of choice in the suburbs. So the laws have in them inherent class imbalance.
Hmm. How did you select the four women for in-depth? There are, well, maybe the most in-depth treatment are for Denise, Julie, and Charlene. There are other women profiled, of course, here as well. But how did you select these women to really hone in on and really get at their stories?
When I first asked for access to MCI Framingham, the only give that the Department of Corrections gave me was they were quite excited about the idea that they could select the women and I could then write about them to my heart's content, which I, of course, had to turn down, though I was tempted for a time because I was so desperate. And how I selected the women was not very scientifically, I have to admit. The first woman I met by chance was Denise, and I found her through an organization called FAM, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, which is a nationwide organization set up to fight against mandatory drug sentences, and all mandatory sentences, actually. And Denise had been doing some work with them from inside Framingham. And then I wanted to be quite careful in having a representative group of women racially, culturally, and from different ages and backgrounds. And so bit by bit, through meeting different women from different organizations outside the prison and also friends of women inside the prison and friends of friends, I finally whittled it down to these women who I felt were a good representative group of the women in MCI Framingham.
Mm. Now, given the stonewalling of the Department of Corrections, were women reluctant to speak with you?
No, quite on the contrary. The courage of the women in prison was humbling. And I only met one woman who didn't want to speak with me. Everybody else was so keen to share their story in the name of women in prison across the country. There's tremendous solidarity between women in prison. Strong friendships are built in prison. And those friendships stretch, if not literally, at least metaphorically, between prisons too, so that these women were determined to have their stories heard because the stories of women in prison have been heard so little. And in the telling of their stories, they found great power and great strength, and I was very privileged to be able to hear them.
Were you seen at all by anyone as, maybe she can get me out of here, I didn't do it? That kind of thing.
Yeah, there was only one woman who, of all the women I met, there was only one woman who insisted she didn't commit her crime. Every other woman was very ready to take responsibility for their actions. The woman who said that she didn't do it quite possibly didn't. She was actually serving time for murder, and I, of course, have no way of telling whether she did it or didn't do it. But the one thing I was very careful about making clear to the women, some of whom, like Charlene, as you mentioned, were serving 15 years in prison, was that I was not a lawyer and that I had no legal training and that I was not there to reduce their sentences or to, you know, work on their case or to help them in that way, that that wasn't what I did. That I was there very simply to help them have their stories and their voices heard. And the women seemed very fine with that, and I was very welcomed by all of them.
How are women's prisons different from men's prisons?
In every way, I think. I mean, of course, they're prisons, and so there's no freedom in them, and that's a unifying force wherever there's no freedom. But women are different from men, and so women in prison are different from men in prison, where men tend to take out their frustrations and despair on each other, making men's prisons rather violent and sometimes frightening places to be. Women take out their feelings of frustration on themselves much more. So the instances of self-cutting and of a suicide attempts are infinitely higher than instances of inmate-on-inmate violence in women's prison. And that really turns everything else on its head. You know, the driving force between women in prison is intimacy, friendship, support. And I think that the driving force between men in prison is much more hierarchical and power-based. And that just affects everything. Everything is different from that starting point.
Yeah. What's the situation when it comes to mental health for women in prison?
You know, mental health is a huge issue facing both men and women in prisons across our country. I think it's about 30% of women in prison are seriously mentally ill. They would be in a residential mental health ward if such places existed. Most of them were closed down in the 80s, and sadly, these women find their way into the prison system instead, where, of course, mental health care comes in a very distant second to security. So this often leads to very tragic circumstances and death. If you're mentally ill and you're acting out as a result of your schizophrenia, at the guard will take that as insolence or insubordination and will punish you by placing you in isolation. And it doesn't take much imagination to know that if you're mentally ill, being alone 23 hours a day is not going to help you. And in fact, it's mostly in those isolation rooms that the women do manage to kill themselves.
Yeah.
So it's a terrible situation. And those are just the seriously mentally ill. More than 60% of women in Framingham have open mental health cases and are on some kind of psychotropic drug. So it's hard to say whether being in prison has created that or whether they had these problems before they came to prison. You know, so many of these women have had difficult, difficult lives. 84% of them are drug addicts when they come in. More than half are victims of sustained physical and sexual abuse. So they're coming into prison with tremendous issues and tremendous blocks to having productive lives when they come out.
Any drug rehab?
There is drug rehab. Its efficacy is constantly debated. Certainly, it's not as useful as if it could be provided in a residential drug rehab facility. Again, the primary concern is security, which means, you know, guards of hours of prison guard time, not hours of rehabilitation time. But it is provided, and it's pretty basic. Everyone goes off drugs cold turkey in Framingham unless you're pregnant. And that detoxing situation is so awful that women who've been in prison before know to avoid it at all costs. And there's just not the kind of sustained counseling and other kinds of drug care that will really enable many women to stay clean once they get out.
In the course of 3.5 years at Framingham, there were 5 deaths. The population, 600 women, seems pretty high.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about the circumstances?
They were all in isolation, some in punitive isolation, commonly known as the hole, and some in psychiatric isolation in the health services unit, which is pretty much exactly like the hole, except that it's on a different corridor. It's exactly like the hole in that you are alone 23 hours a day. You're let out for exercise for 1 hour a day. And these are circumstances which could drive any sane person mad pretty quickly. And if you have mental issues when you're sent there, your madness comes on pretty strongly. Most of the women died as a result of self-strangulation. They would twist pieces of sheet around either the bed leg or a ventilation grate and hang themselves to death. There were two sisters I spent some time with in Framingham. I spent time with one. The younger sister had already hung herself by the time I met the older. She had hung herself in a solitary cell in the psychiatric unit in Framingham. And less than 6 months later, her sister tried to kill herself by jumping out of the fourth-story window of the Catholic chapel and miraculously survived. But both of these women, as is the case with almost every woman who kills themselves in prison, had long cases of mental health issues, which were pretty much ignored by the prison authorities, or certainly which weren't satisfactorily dealt with. There isn't sufficient psychiatric care, and there isn't sufficient sustained care of any kind. And so that's what happened. These women begin by cutting themselves, and some of them end up taking their own lives. And again, you know, most of these women are serving time for nonviolent offenses, petty offenses. Some are even in their serving time while they await trial, so they haven't even been sentenced. The last woman who killed herself in this prison died about a year and a half ago, and she was in the awaiting trial unit, awaiting a trial on charges of prostitution. And so, in a way, you could say that she received a death sentence for these small behavioral crimes.
Mm.
She shouldn't have died.
Yeah. At the end of A World Apart, we see Denise released from prison. She's completed her sentence. How did prison change her? And tell us what it was like to be with her. I assume you were with her, if I'm recalling correctly.
No, I was.
When you went to a farmer's market.
One of the ways Denise found to survive in prison, and each woman, of course, as an individual human being, finds their own way, the way Denise found was to focus very much on physical fitness and nutrition. She became very fascinated by finding ways to eat healthy meals in prison and to maintain her exercise schedule. And she, in fact, ended up starting an exercise class for women in prison. And that sustained her. But her longing for fresh fruit and vegetables was sustained and tormenting throughout her whole time in prison. And so one of the things she was determined to do the day she got out was to go to a farmer's market and just, she imagined herself just going wild with all that fruit and vegetables and having a feast. We had gone to a restaurant beforehand, and that had gone pretty much okay. And then we went to the farmer's market, and just the range and the color and the extent of the fresh produce in front of her and the choices she would have had to make in just purchasing some of those fruit and vegetables was beyond her on that first day. You know, she spent a few minutes wandering down the aisles, but in the end, she just burst into tears. She was overwhelmed entirely, and we had to leave.
Yeah. And what's Patrick's situation today?
He is now 16. He just turned 16. And he has just been released again from a juvenile facility where he was placed again for a behavioral crime, for staying out too late, even though Denise has been an incredible mother both inside prison and out. It's been very hard for her to regain custody of her son since he was made a ward of the state after he was abused by his father. And so he's still a ward of the state, though he lives with her. But if he violates these laws that the state places on him, rather than, you know, being grounded for a week, as so many of us parents do with our own teenagers, he's sent back into the juvenile facility. There's nothing that Denise can do about this until she's granted custody. And that's just a long, complex, time-consuming process. And so he's doing pretty well. He's an amazing kid. But it's a difficult road he has to hoe. And all teenagers have a difficult time. But he's obviously had a much harder time than most, and therefore is having a harder time now.
Is A World Apart getting a lot of attention?
You know, I'm surprised by the attention it's getting. It actually is. Not mostly from sort of Random House publicity events so much as from groups that are working with women in prison and groups that are interested in doing so and political groups that are legislatively working to change the laws. And I've been incredibly gratified by that. I very much tried to keep this book, and I think I succeeded in making it a narrative, you know, keeping it story-based and making it accessible to anyone who likes to read. Certainly the stories of these women are compelling and funny and crazy, as well as sad and depressing and horrifying. I mean, there's plenty of life in prison to enliven any book. But I think for the most part that the population it's serving now is people who care about the issue already, and it's galvanizing them, and that feels really good.
Mm. There we have to leave it. Christina, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Christina Rathbone has been our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's a journalist. Her latest book, A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. The book is published by Random House. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. We'll have those in just a moment.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
And now here with settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade, Todd Gleason.
Hey, Celeste, very quickly, just a word of thank you for expanding the time frame for a closing market report, although you didn't have much choice yesterday. I do appreciate it.
We gave
it.
You a thumbs up. So
I figured you did. It's not often you have the Secretary of Agriculture
right.
or any cabinet member on live with you. And
right.
the other media wouldn't let go of him. Actually, he wouldn't let go of the other media and walked in late. I was kind of in a blind spot.
Yeah.
Couldn't see or hear. And I was just dancing, waiting for him to come in. But I do appreciate you doing that a great deal. Thanks much. Let's take a look now at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. What a day at the Board of Trade today. Futures in the bean pit look like this. They were up 23 cents in the nearby. The November contract was up 21. Some technical-driven things happening there. Also, the weather factor as dry weather continues across the Midwest. And then Informa came out with some numbers this morning that showed they expect USDA on June the 30th to post a million acres fewer soybeans planted this season, than what had been expected back in March. Now, the numbers from the Board of Trade like this. July futures in the high for the wheat, 329.5, the low at 310.5. Settlement price, that's for the week, actually. The high today, a 329.5 high, the low at 325, and a settlement price at 327.5, 4 cents higher for the day. September futures up 4.25, 339.5, the high, the low at 35. Settlement price there at 337.5, and they were up 4.25. December contract 5.25 higher, 348.75 the settlement. The high at 50 even, the low at 46.5 of the December wheat. Soft red winter wheat, March contract, 2006, 361, the high, the low at 357, settled $3.59 a bushel, up a nickel, and the May futures were up 3 cents today, 362, the high, the low at 60, and a settlement price on net low at $3.60 a bushel for the May wheat. July corn up 3.25, 229.5, the high, the low at 226.75, that 3.25 settlement price higher at $2.29. September futures, 238.75, the high, the low at 235.75, settled 238.5 for the SEP corn, up 3.75 in the December. This year, new crop harvest month, $2.49.25, the high, the low at 246, settlement price at 249, up 3.5. March futures through at 256.25, the high, the low at 253.25, settlement price at $2.56, up 2.75, and the May of next year, 259 corn contract, or rather 259 was high on that corn contract, the low at 256.25, settlement price at $2.58.75. They were up 2.5 on the day. July futures for next year, the high today 262, the low at 258.75, settlement price at $2.62. They were up 2 cents for the day. July bean oil 153, the high, the low at 150.40, settled 152.20, up $2. Or rather, this is not bean oil. This is July oats. I'm just getting way ahead of myself. July oats 153, the high, the low at 150.5, a settlement price at 152.25, up $2. And the September futures 157.5, the high, the low at 155.25, settlement price at $1.56.75 in the September oats. They were up 2.25 for the day. July soybeans now 23.25 higher today, 727.5, the high, the low at 710, settlement price at $7.24 even, up 23.25 in the July contract. August futures 731.5, the high, the low at $7.15, settled 727.5, up 21.25 in the September's, 735 the high, Low at 717.5, settled $7.31.5, up 21 for the day. November contract, 746 the high, the low at 729, settled 741.5, 21 cents higher. And the January future, 746.5 the high, the low at 730, settled 742.5, up 22.5. March contract now, 732 the high, the low at 718, settled 728.5, up 18.25. July bean meal, 230.30 the high, the low at 225.10, settled at $229 even. They were up $6 today. August bean oil up 580, 230.50 the high, the low at 225.50, settlement price at 228.70. Bean oil futures, a move there as well, up 98 for the day, 25.27 the high, the low at 24.42, settlement price at 25.08, 98 higher. And July or August bean oil, 25.30 the high, the low at 24.47, settlement price at 25.21, and they were up 103 for the day. Now, here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, let's look at what happened today on the Merc. Prices were lower. August feeder cattle, 108.25, the high, the low, 107.05. The settlement, 107.57.5, that down 27.5. September, 107 even, the high, 106.07.5, the low, 106.35, the settlement, that down 32.5. October, 105.85, the high, 104.80, the low, the settlement, 105.15, that down 47.5. June live cattle, 81.95, the high, 80.70, the low, 81.20, the settlement, that unchanged. August, 80.10, the high, 79.20, the low, the settlement, 79.90, that up 47.5. July lean hog, 68.50, the high, 65.95, the low, 65.95, the settlement, that down the limit, down $2. August, 67.27.5, the high, 64.82.5, the low, the settlement, 64.90, that down 172.5. October, 57.90, the high, 55.80, the low, 55.87.5, the settlement, that down 167.5. December lean hogs, 55.17.5, the high, 53.80, the low, the settlement, 53.92.5, that down $1. July bellies, 66.20, the high, 64.10, the low, 64.45, the settlement, that down 132.5. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 40 points at 10,618. The NASDAQ off 1 at 2088. The S&P 500 up 5 at 1216.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Catherine Grayson from Melbourne, Australia wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, can you test the UV protection efficiency of sunscreen using photography paper?
You could, but it would be a roundabout way to test your sunscreen. Why not just rub it on your back? If you need to have the experiment seem more convoluted or scientific, you could rub it on the backs of laboratory rats or students on work study and then expose them to the midday sun. Remember to take copious notes and